The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. Can you hear okay? Outside? Okay. Last week I gave a talk on investigation, and I thought I would little bit follow up, somehow building on that or continuing a little bit that theme perhaps, and also introduce you to a particular discourse of the Buddha that said to come from the Buddha, but I have my doubts that at least all of it came from the Buddha. It comes from a collection called the Long Discourses of the Buddha, and the Long Discourses as a whole, many of them seem to be fairly literary works, so more self-consciously made or written, seems kind of unlikely that they kind of accurately record something that actually happened. And some of them have have a lot of supernatural elements to them, the gods visit the Buddha and different things. And it, for people who believe those things, they might seem real. But the context of some of these stories, it seems like they're more literary techniques for emphasizing a point, or to be funny. And there is a humor in the ancient Buddhist texts, but most readers wouldn't know that on the first reading. You have to kind of spend some time with the text and kind of know a little bit of context and stuff to begin seeing that there's maybe some satire going on or irony going on or some kind of jesting going on. And in this particular discourse, it has a somewhat lengthy introduction, which is setting up the teachings later on, maybe to make a point, to make a contrast. And the contrast is between a life of sensual indulgence, perhaps, and a life of the ascetic. The Buddha is kind of an ascetic, a renunciant, someone who has renounced the usual sensual pleasures that people pursue in their lives. And in the ancient Indian kind of view of things, it was a person who led a life of purity, and so wasn't caught up in all kind of impure pursuits of the senses, perhaps. And so the story opens up with Saka, who is one of the great, in a particular, Buddhism has a lot of levels of heaven, and there's one level of heaven where there's 33 gods or something, and he's the king of those 33 gods. So he's kind of important in his realm. And it dawns on him that he'd like to go see the Buddha, talk to the Buddha. So he scans around the cosmos, and he sees that the Buddha is in a cave meditating. So he decides to go to this cave. And he sees that the Buddha is in very deep meditation. So, you know, you don't just kind of barge in on the Buddha when he's meditating, you know, like, hey. And you approach it in the appropriate way. You know, imagine if I sent you, hey, you know, go and Buddha's down the street and he's meditating, but could you kind of rouse him from his meditation so I could talk to him? You know, you probably go with some care and perhaps talk gently or quietly to get his attention and try to bring him out. So Saka sends, he has this kind of a, someone he knew who was with him, attendant, who was a celestial musician called a Gandhaba, not quite a god, but celestial musician. And he says to the musician, you, could you go down there to the Buddha and sing him a song? Play your wonderful lute, and somehow bring him out of meditation so that we can have a conversation. So this celestial musician goes to the Buddha and starts singing his lute and singing a song. And the song that he chooses to sing would be maybe, you know, if you say the Pope was taking a nap at your house and it was time to wake the Pope up, and because I don't know the new songs, but you put on the Doors, come on baby, light my fire. it would be a little bit odd song for the Pope, come on. And so this is kind of in that style that this celestial musician sings a song to the Buddha. And the song is, and even within the song, there are these contrasts in the song, kind of ironic contrasts, where the pursuit of sensual, sexual passion is put in the context or put in comparison to the pursuit of spiritual liberation and freedom as a contrast, or kind of they play off each other in a kind of, I think it was meant to be a humorous way. Not only can you believe this guy's using "Come on, baby, light my fire" to get the Buddha, but now he's saying these odd things about, misunderstand what Buddhism is about almost. So this is the in some ways probably the most erotic of the poems or songs or pieces of literature in this early Buddhist canon. So, and the usual translations of it are, a little bit polite. So you don't get the full flavor if you read some of the standard translations. So I translated it, so I'll read you my translation. And if it's offensive to any of you, I apologize. And if you came here to not be reminded of these things, to be liberated and free, and then you can kind of stay tuned and see how the Buddha responded when he was in fact aroused out of his meditation, how he responded to having heard this kind of song. Be curious, what would the Buddha, what did he think of this? What did he say in response to hearing this? So I don't know what tune it was, and I can't sing, but this celestial musician, as explains later, he fell in love with another woman, celestial musician, and he was, hot after her. And apparently, initially, it was unrequited, or he couldn't quite get what he wanted, and so he wrote this song. "My lady, O sunshine, I revere your father, Timbaru, who fathered such a lovely lady, the cause of my delight. As a breeze pleases one who sweats, as water pleases one who thirsts, as the Dharma pleases an awakened one, so do you, radiant one, please me. Like medicine for the sick and food for the hungry, O lady, as if a fire is burning, cool me. May the fruit..." "As an elephant, overcome by summer's heat, plunges into petals and pollen covering a cool lotus pond, so would I plunge into your breasts and belly. As an elephant beyond the reach of the goad, unfazed by prods and sticks, I know not what is proper to do, intoxicated by the quality of your thighs. My heart is filled with yearning and bent out of shape, like a fish that swallowed a hook. I cannot turn back. Embrace me, O lady of gorgeous thighs. Embrace me, O lady of tender eyes. Embrace me fully, lovely lady. This is my greatest wish. At first, my desire for you was small, you of curly hair. But it has multiplied like an offering does to an awakened one. May the fruit of the merit from the deeds I've done for awakened ones Be that we are together, O Lady, lovely in every limb. May the fruit of the merit from deeds I've done throughout the world be that we are together, O Lady, lovely in every limb. As the Buddha in meditative absorption is one-pointed, intent, and mindful, so a sage seeks the deathless, and I seek you, O Lady Sunshine. As a sage would rejoice in gaining the supreme awakening, so would I rejoice that I may have intercourse with you, my lovely lady. If Sakka, Lord of the 33 gods, were to grant me a wish, it is you, my lady, I would wish for. My passion is that strong. As I would venerate a salt tree newly blooming, O wise lady, I venerate your father who had an offering such as you, an offspring such as you. So that's about as risque as it gets in these suttas. And you know, he contrasts, you know, how much the Dharma pleases an awakened one, someone who's enlightened, with how much she pleases him. Or how much, it says here, and he compares, you make all these offerings, you get merit. Usually if you make merit, you usually can use that merit, you can kind of cash it in this ancient economy, spiritual economy, for something really good. And so generally, they have merit, you're supposed to cash it in for, you know, spiritual benefit. And so, he wants to cash it in to be with his lady. And just as a sage seeks the deathless, a word for enlightenment, or the way the Buddha is intent or one-pointed in his meditation, so he seeks and he's one-pointed for this lady. So, you know, I bet in the old times people laughed at this, you know, the contrast here, the Buddha sitting in meditation, and this is the song that's, you know, sung. And so the Buddha comes out of meditation. It works. And this is what the Buddha says, hearing it. When he heard this, the Buddha said, by the way, the name of the celestial musician, this is part of, again, this literary thing, you know, and the contrast, the irony and all that. His name is Panchasika, which we could translate as the five precepts. So, you know, that's another little contrast, because you don't think of someone who's engaged in the five precepts to have this kind of song. Though he didn't break any precepts writing the song. So, Panchasika, the sound of your strings blends so well with your song, and your song with the strings, that neither prevails excessively over the other. When did you compose these verses on the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Arhats, and love? Isn't that nice and gentle? It's kind of beautiful. Buddha comes out of meditation, and he doesn't, you know, say, you know, what were you doing? He's saying, oh, that's it was well done, well composed. When did you write it? Then he tells a story of how he wrote it. So that's the kind of prelude that sets up then the conversation between Sakka, this, you know, great god, and the Buddha. And so you already see a contrast, kind of a game or a play in place of this between someone who's spiritually free and liberated, someone who has freed themselves from the grip of sensual passion and addiction, versus someone who seemingly is addicted to his passion for this lady and wants it at all costs, and says he's intoxicated, likens his desire for this woman like a fish that has caught a hook in its mouth. So it's a pretty powerful image. Not that any of you have had that. And then, so the contrast between one pursuit in life, the renunciant pursuit of freedom, and a worldly pursuit of sensual desire and love or something. So then Sakya goes to the Buddha, and he asks him this. What fetters, by what attachments, are beings bound? So by what attachments are we caught up, are we tied up, are we entangled? Are we limited? Are we held back? Do we lose our freedom? Are we bound? And then he goes through a list, because he says, what are beings? So gods, humans, asuras, nagas, gandhavas, and whatever other kinds there may be. So the idea that all these mythical beings, all the gods and the celestial musicians and nagas, or the great kind of serpents, or all of them are capable of being bound and caught, even though gods have this beautiful, in Buddhism, the gods have this beautiful, very enjoyable life. It's still, they're also capable of being bound. By what fetter, sir, are beings bound? Whereby, although they wish to live without hate, harming, hostility, or malignity, and in peace, they yet live in hate, harming one another, hostile and malign. This was Sakya's question to the Buddha, and the Buddha replied, it is the bonds of jealousy and avarice that bind beings so that, though they wish to live without hate, yet they live in hate, harming one another, hostile. This was the Buddha's reply. So it is, Sakya exclaimed, so it is. But then, having expressed his appreciation for the answer, asked another question. But sir, what gives rise to jealousy and avarice? What is their origin? How are they born? How do they arise? Owing to the presence of what do they arise? Owing to the absence of what do they arise? So this kind of question, what gives rise to something else, is a very important approach to investigation, a very important approach to Buddhist, kind of the practice of Buddhism. And sometimes it's confused, especially in the Western mind, with analysis and psychoanalysis and kind of looking back into your past, why did something happen? But this is not what's meant here, but rather, what's the kind of universal qualities that are operating in you, or in anyone, that might give birth to hate, to hostility, to loss of peace? And the qualities, they don't go back to a story here, they just go back to particular mental qualities, particular qualities going on. So the Buddha replies, so again, this question, and so the idea is to understand a little bit about cause and effect, to understand a little bit about what is it that gives rise to something. So if you cling, if you're attached, in Buddhism, you're not just supposed to let go of your attachment. It's really important to understand what gives birth to that attachment. What is it that gives rise to? So you understand something about the causes and conditions that run your life and what goes on. So there's wisdom and understanding as part of it. So he starts asking these kinds of questions, which are the kind of questions that we're supposed to ask in practice. So what gives rise here, in this case, to jealousy and avarice? What is their origin? How are they born, and how do they arise? Owing to the presence of what do they arise? Owing to the absence of what do they not arise? Jealousy and avarice, the Buddha replied, take rise from liking and disliking. This is their origin. This is how they are born, how they arise. When these are present, they arise. When these are absent, they do not arise. But sir, said Sakya, what gives rise to like and dislike? And the Buddha replied, desire. Desire gives rise to like and dislike. And then, what gives rise to desire? And the Buddha said, the mind that thinks about something. When the mind thinks about... So, desire arises from thinking. When the mind thinks about something, desire arises. When the mind thinks about nothing, desire does not arise. But sir, what gives rise to thinking? This is interesting. This is the last one here, this one. thinking arise from the tendency to objectify. When this tendency is present, thinking arises. When this is absent, thinking does not arise. So it's not clear that the word vitakka, which is here used translated as thinking, means every form of thinking you could possibly do. But there's a certain kind of thinking, perhaps. And the idea that objectification, so we're going back to the source for things like jealousy, for hate, for hostility. And you could trace that back to the source. One of the source is here is objectification. And objectification, what this means in this tradition, is it means fixating on something that's out there as an object, and you here as a subject. Fixating on that—that's a very key word. So treating something as an object and having that sense of separation. It's not necessary to experience something and see it as an object. It's possible to see without the fixation, without the holding on. But once we fixate, once we have things as an object, then we start thinking about it, and often that thinking can be obsessive thinking. We get lost in thinking about that object. And if we get lost in thinking and obsessing about the object, then it's easy to have desire for it. Once we have desire, then we have preferences, likes and dislikes. Once we have likes and dislikes, then there can be jealousy and avarice and, you know, craving. And once you have that, then it's easy to give rise to hate and hostility, the loss of your peace. So it might seem somewhat complicated, but there's kind of layers of how the mind operates. And when we bring mindfulness to what's happening, and in our tradition, the idea is to be mindful of what we can see directly, what's actually going on, it's obvious. But as you're present for things, you begin seeing cracks in your experience. You begin seeing that actually there's something behind it that's prompting it or eliciting it. So, for example, it's not so uncommon for people to discover that behind their anger there might be fear, or behind their anger there might be a sense of hurt. And it might not be obvious at first, but if you're present for your anger, you might see that there's layers there that's going on. Or there might be a craving for food, but if you really are present for that craving, some people find that they're lonely or feeling unhappy, and the food craving is really a way to kind of compensate for that, perhaps. So there's many kind of layers of this, how this works. And here the suggestion is that underneath it all, a very important layer is this way in which we objectify the world. We kind of see things as being, as objects of things that we can think about in some kind of obsessive way. So then Sakka asks, what practice has that monk undertaken who has reached the way which leads to the cessation of this tendency to objectify? So what kind of practice do you do so you stop kind of living this objectifying world? So this is one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk today. So if you're beginning to fade away from this, now you're supposed to wake up. Notice here. Now, so the Buddha said, I declare that there are two kinds of happiness. The word here translates happiness could also be translated as joy or mental well-being. There are two kinds of happiness: the kind to be pursued and the kind to be avoided. The same applies to unhappiness and equanimity. In other words, there's the kind of unhappiness that should be pursued and the kind that should not be pursued. There's a kind of equanimity that should be pursued and the kind that should not be pursued. So this is a very interesting statement. And one of the ways I think is interesting is that some people, when they listen to Buddhist teachings, especially this contrast between the path of sensual desire that this celestial musician represents and the path of liberation that the Buddha represents, can start in a very simplistic way, say that the world of sensuality is bad, all kinds, and the pursuit of that kind of well-being, that kind of joy, that kind of happiness, should not happen. And you should just be a renunciate, you should cut yourself off from a whole bunch of part of your life and live some kind of abstract idea of what you think is supposed to be a pure life, a spiritual life, a Buddhist life, and cut off parts of your life out of some kind of policy, one or the other. Have some of you heard something like that? Or no? No, not at all. None of you have been troubled by that, so that's good. So here he says, so there's two kinds of happiness, one that should be pursued and one who shouldn't. And the should here is not that you should, like you're obligated, but if what you want to do is to end this objectification, which lies at the root of all these problems that people can have. So this is how I understood. So why have I declared this in regard to happiness? This is how I understood happiness. When I observed, so the Buddha is talking about his own practice and what he observed, what he noticed. When I observe that in the pursuit of such happiness, unskillful factors of my mind increased and skillful factors decreased, then that happiness was to be avoided. And when I observed that in the pursuit of such happiness, unskillful factors of mind, qualities of mind, decreased, and skillful qualities of mind increased, then that happiness was to be sought after. So this is a very significant approach. You need to investigate, you need to see what the consequences are of what you pursue, what you do. So if you it's good to want happiness, it's fine to want joy, delight, and mental well-being. And I would say that it's not so useful to have some kind of abstract category idea, like this is bad and this is good. But rather you want to look at what's happening, what you're doing, and investigate, study the effect it has on you. And in particular, study the effect on the quality of your mental factors, the quality of the capacities of your mind that are operating. So, you know, if you spend a lot of time pursuing hateful thoughts and just kind of just being complaining and hating people left and right, probably if you pay attention, you note that that's going to reinforce a habit of always being aversive and angry and hateful. If you do generous activity regularly, you'll probably find that your quality of your generosity increases. Generosity becomes more of a habit or a quality or a strength for you. If you live a life of honesty and you're truthful, the quality of your integrity will get stronger in your mind. You can see that. If you live a life of dishonesty, you probably see that the qualities, mental factors that go along with dishonesty and deceit get stronger. We have an effect, and we can measure, we can look and feel and sense how things affect our mind. And from that, we can learn. And it's from studying how it affects our mind that we find the way forward, not from having some kind of abstract principle that we then blindly adhere to. So when you engage in something, what is the effect it has on you? Now, one way that people measure or analyze or look at this would be say, well, it just feels good. Or I just feel happy when this happens. It was a good experience. And here the Buddha is not using that as a criteria, but rather using the criteria, are there qualities, good qualities, skillful, helpful qualities in my mind which are increasing? Or are there unhelpful qualities of mind which are decreasing? You know, how's it affecting qualities of mind? And this is one of the reasons this is important is that how you feel from one moment to the next, one day to the next, is pretty fickle. And, you know, things can change quickly and, you know, and you can feel like, I got it made, I feel really great. And then, you know, 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, an hour later, next day, you know, you wake up on the wrong side of the bed or you get the wrong, you know, I don't know what happens. And then you feel lousy. So to measure your life by how good you feel is measuring becoming pretty fickle and unreliable. But the quality of your mind, the qualities, the factors of your mind, is a little bit like a muscle that you can strengthen. And if you strengthen those which are helpful, they persist longer through your days and through a month than a particular how you feel. So I want to reemphasize this, that for many people, they use how they feel as a criteria for judging how they are and, you know, whether this is good or bad. And the Buddha is suggesting, don't measure how you feel, but measure the consequence on how, what you're doing and how you feel on the quality of your mind. The factors of your mind, the activities of your mind, those capacities get stronger or weaker. So if what you're pursuing brings you happiness, don't use the happiness by itself as the criteria. Happiness is an experience that can be fickle. Look at the happiness you have and look at how that affects the inner qualities of your mind. So I can get happy, maybe, if I win the California lottery. But the people who've studied, they've done these kind of research projects of people who've won lotteries, and in fact, people seemingly say they're very happy right away, but seemingly most people after a year, after winning a big lottery, are not happy. They're less happy than they were before they won the lottery. That's quite something, right? We don't advertise that when we sell lottery tickets. Get a ticket, you have a chance to win, and after a year, you'll feel lousier. But certain kinds of happiness don't produce good qualities in your mind. You can get happy because you get praised by someone for how incredibly wonderful you are. And so now your happiness has puffed up your ego. If you're paying attention, you feel happy, but you feel how puffed up you are. And it's just a setup, because the next person comes around and says something bad about you and pops the bubble of your puffed upness, you're going to feel worse. There's a different kind of happiness, the happiness that you get by not playing the ego game, the conceit game. Letting go of being concerned whether people think you're the most wonderful or whether you're the worst. And that's a different kind of happiness. That kind of happiness is more reliable. That produces qualities that mind is more content and more peaceful and more happy. So, nowadays the pursuit of happiness has become a whole research topic and very important for many people. And here what the Buddha says, yes, the pursuit of happiness is fine, but don't pursue happiness for its own sake. As you pursue happiness, you should know, you should investigate your happiness. So what should be pursued and what shouldn't, by how it affects the qualities, the inner character of your mind. And then interestingly, he says the same thing about unhappiness. You should not pursue the unhappiness, the misery, unhappiness, that makes the qualities of your mind worse. But perhaps there are times when things that make you unhappy, or here maybe the translation is not quite right. The word is domasana, which means something like a poor mind, or a bad mind, or a kind of not so good mind, unhappy mind. Perhaps it's okay. But are there times when you do something that doesn't make you feel good, but doing it increases the good qualities of your mind, increases your patience, your equanimity, it helps you see yourself more deeply, it teaches you patience, it challenges your attachments, it's a way of cultivating your compassion perhaps, even your love sometimes when you are doing something out of love for someone else, but you know it's kind of difficult for you to do and uncomfortable to do. You know, the idea that we're only supposed to be happy, I think, is misery. And it's kind of oppressive. And I know some people who feel when they're unhappy that they're a spiritual failure. You know, because if you're a good Buddhist, you're supposed to be floating on a cloud all the time. You know, and nothing's supposed to bother you. You always feel, you know, light and clear. But perhaps there are some forms of unhappiness which come with being a human being, and some of them which are even appropriate and here should be pursued because they lead to the greater good of yourself and cultivating yourself, developing yourself in some way. And the same thing about equanimity. He doesn't explain what he means by this equanimity, the different kinds of equanimity, but there are some types of equanimity of kind of being equanimous or maybe indifferent or somehow unfazed, unaffected by things, that is not really so healthy. It doesn't really have a good effect on you. And some, I think Buddhists have this sometimes this fault where because Buddhism emphasizes so much letting go and being peaceful and being equanimous, sometimes it's a little bit enforced equanimity where they kind of shut down or kind of... which is not so good. You can see how it doesn't really affect you very well. And then there's an equanimity that actually supports good qualities of mind. So this is the point about investigation, is that it's up to us to investigate the qualities of our mind, to learn what qualities of mind to focus on, to notice, to have the capacity to be mindful enough to see, not be lost in the world of things and ideas and thoughts, but have the capacity to turn the attention around so the mind can see itself, so the awareness can see what's operating in the mind, how it feels, what muscles in the mind are being used and operating. And to take some heart, to take that piece of encouragement, that it's a very valuable thing to strengthen good qualities of mind. And so when things are really hard and difficult, sometimes, you know, things are almost impossible to work through and it seems like, you know, things are, it's easy to succumb and give up and feel like it's hopeless. But for a Buddhist practitioner, there's always hope. Maybe not a hope for the solution for what you're trying to solve, but there's always hope that you can develop yourself and cultivate a stronger mind, cultivate stronger qualities. If you think that the only thing, the only game in town is fixing all your problems, the problem of the day, you live a kind of narrow life. Certainly fix your problems if they're helpful to do that. But there's other games, there's other activities, other things, other dimensions going on. There's also the dimension that we're also cultivating our mind, cultivating our hearts. And perhaps you can fail at your problem and succeed and bettering your mind. Because you fell back on, you cultivated your patience the best you could, your generosity, your wisdom, your letting go. It's a lot of things you might have been cultivating even though you failed in the particular thing that was important to try to succeed at. So investigation, investigating the qualities of your mind. So that's my thoughts today. And that way, if you... you don't have to choose between being an ascetic or being a sensualist. That one is better than the other, especially for lay people. You're all lay people, and so the idea is you're not. Probably most of you haven't made a commitment to being celibate or avoiding certain kind of sensual pleasures, but you do have a capacity to look at your pursuits and how you live, if you're involved in sensual pleasures, for example, and seeing, does this particular pursuit of sensual pleasure, what effect does it have? What qualities of mind are being developed as I do it? Is it qualities of mind that are helpful or qualities of mind which are not helpful? And that's, you know, only you can be responsible for that. But if you're blinded by the pleasure, sensual pleasure in and of itself, then you might not notice the consequence, the effect it has on you. And it might not be a good one if you're addicted. But if you pay careful attention and use as a guide that you're cultivating good qualities, chances are that the sensual activities you're involved in might not only be good for you, it might actually be nice for someone else too. Because perhaps you're coming from love, from generosity, from caring, from compassion, things like that. So I believe, at least the house, I like to understand Buddhism, that for lay people, that we're not for or against sensual pleasures or sexual pleasures, but we are definitely for investigating what's going on and learning from that and not doing it blindly. So, what do you think? Now we have a few minutes if you want to make some comments or... Yes, please.
Hi. I definitely see the value in cultivating qualities of the mind. As you were talking about the effect of happiness on the qualities of mind, what I was reminded of is the fact that there are times when happiness becomes uncomfortable or brings up feelings that aren't easy because we have beliefs or blueprints or mindsets that are not in alignment with being able to receive that level of happiness. And so...
So you're saying that you're feeling happy, but it goes counter to ideas that somehow you're not supposed to be this happy.
That we learned at different points in time.
Yeah, and that happens. So that's a challenge.
Yeah, and so I wondered if you have suggestions of how to distinguish between the discomfort that's good because it's that we're at the edge of our comfort zone and the discomfort that is maybe not so helpful or wholesome, and whether you have suggestions of how to be with the discomfort that sits at the edge of our comfort zone.
Well, in terms of the theme of today's talk, investigate it all. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, try to look more and more carefully what's actually going on for you and try to understand. And so that takes patience and it takes willingness to stay and stop and be present. And so one of the things we're trying to learn in any kind of Buddhist practice, I believe, is learning to have the ability to stay present for things which are uncomfortable. And not for its own sake, so we can be better, more comfortable, better, but so that we can then do that investigation to look, what's going on there with my discomfort? So if you're uncomfortable with a degree of happiness somehow you feel, you know, it might take a while to see where that discomfort comes from. Maybe there's very, very quiet, subtle thoughts or beliefs that are operating in the background. And then it might take a while to see that those beliefs are there because they were probably, they might have been kind of conditioned in very early time in life. So it takes a while to see that. Or there might be other thoughts and beliefs operating. Sometimes people compare themselves to others, and so like there's guilt that comes in. You know, I'm happy, but, you know, my sister, she's miserable and sick, and is it okay for me to be happy when she's so terrible, and you know, or this and that? You know, all the comparison can happen, or perhaps you know. So we start seeing, and without that investigation, and without the willingness to explore how to learn how to be comfortable with discomfort, I don't think you're going to go very far. So I don't know. I don't know if I responded accurately, you know, appropriately to your question, but is that close enough as an answer? I remember once many years ago, there was a woman from, she was an Irish Catholic, and she was on retreat, and she was sitting meditating on retreat, and all this physical joy or pleasure started coming up, because meditation can sometimes bring a lot of pleasure and joy as part of it. And because of her particular religious kind of conditioning, she had understood that was really bad and kind of sinful to have this kind of physical joy and delight. And so she was kind of feeling unhappy or bad about it. And so I remember it was a really great moment as a teacher, because I kind of, you know, sat up straight, put on my teacherly authority, and looked her in the eye and said, "It's completely appropriate, completely fine or good for you to have this kind of joy." And she relaxed. Oh, really? Some great authority figure said the opposite at some point. So I thought maybe the right medicine is to kind of assume some authority here and kind of say this is how it is. And maybe I made it worse, but She relaxed. So yeah, there's a lot of reasons why people sometimes are unwilling to feel happy. And guilt, comparison to others, lessons that it's inappropriate, you know, many things. And I think it's really, really important to question those. And not only to question the sources of them, the beliefs, but also to begin considering what the benefits are from the happiness. And it might be that you actually can be much more helpful to other people if you have some real sense of well-being yourself. So, I have a feeling, I'd like to have one more comment or question. Is it okay to ask? If anybody has anything more? Yes.
I was kind of wondering, could looking at the consequences of these actions be kind of a contemporary understanding of karma, or would that be a different ballgame?
Karma has to do with understanding consequences, and realize our understanding that our actions have consequences. Our karma has to do with understanding what our contributions are to the consequences of actions. So it's closely connected, those two. But maybe you need to say what you mean by karma, what you mean by karma.
I guess I've tried to come up with what's useful for me or what I believe in. So when I've heard karma being discussed as influencing, like someone's actions influencing the world, I guess I've tried to think of it in a very sort of secular way. So when I heard one of the nuns when I was in San Francisco talk about how she had changed her life and she felt that living a more wholesome life had made her feel, had changed her, basically, her inner landscape, that to me I was wondering, well, that seems like the consequences of her action are changing her own inner life, and to me that sort of made sense as a way of understanding karma.
Yes, I think it's a great thing. I think the Buddha's teachings on karma, as I understand it, are not to explain the past or explain the future, but to encourage us to pay really careful attention to the present, because the choices that we make in the present are consequential in the future. And we're the artists, we're the creators, we're the craftspeople of our lives to a certain degree, not completely, but a certain degree, by what we act on and how we think and what we do in the present. And so the whole emphasis in Buddhist karma teaching is to encourage you to stay present for where you have a choice, where you can make a difference. And you can make a big difference. And the nuns are a beautiful example of people who have changed themselves dramatically. So the inner landscape, the inner life, has these beautiful, healthy qualities that are the qualities that are the foundation for a healthy happiness. Okay, so so now you know what to sing to the Buddha when you if you need to. Thank you.